Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust. Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, a show that opens up, explores, tries to understand the cultures of consciousness. And one of the first ways I learned how to really explore this curious connection of culture and the hinterlands of the mind was through literature. Probably no one listening to the show, and I assume many people who would be inspired by its themes would be surprised to know that I'm a big fan of fantasy and science fiction literature. In fact, a lot of my interest in religion emerges from my interest in fantasy. And when I was a kid, I was a huge fan of Lord of the Rings, and I read it many times. And I had a poster of Middle Earth on my wall, and I didn't buy a pre-manufactured one, which back in those days in the 70s was easy to find. I assume following the Peter Jackson films, they're once again part of the pop culture arcana. But at that time, I was not satisfied with the maps I could buy. So I Xeroxed the maps, so they were black and white, and then I taped them together and I burned the edges of the map. And then a friend showed me this trick where you flick water on the page and then hold it over a flame and it gets this little nice aged spot on it. And it was an interesting kind of invocation, this attempt to create a sort of real artifact of a fantasy world. And I had that on my wall for many, many, many years. And I've been thinking about that map in terms of our today's guest, Michael Saylor, who's just come out with a book, As If, Modern Enchantment and the Literary Prehistory of Virtual Reality. And Michael's a professor of history at UC Davis, and it's a wonderful book. It's one of my favorite books I've ever read about fantasy, not just as a specific genre, but the act of fantasy in our modern world, and particularly how it helps build these sort of, well, like he says, proto-virtual worlds. There's a big chunk on H.P. Lovecraft, fascinating stuff on Sherlock Holmes, and it's really been an inspiring thing. So I look forward to grilling Michael about this book. But first I'll bring on our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daoust. Another fantasy fan, no doubt.
I'm a huge fantasy fan. I would go off on some pretty crazy trips like you with the map. That was really funny. I would literally draw out maps for worlds that didn't have it in there. Like, you know, he was nice enough to put in this map, but then there'd be other books that I would read, like fantasy books, and they wouldn't have that in there. So I would spend hours, like, figuring it out and laying out the land that they would describe in the book and kind of make it real on a map of my own.
Yeah, there's something about that, that desire to kind of make it real. I was actually just online yesterday poking around about William Hope Hodgson's book, Nightlands, which my friends at High Lowbrow Books are going to reissue this year. And I came across a couple of different maps that people had created because they didn't come along with the book initially. And I remember, actually, the Battle of Helm's Deep in the Two Towers. When I first read it, I was 10 years old, and so, you know, I was a good reader, but, you know, there's only so far a 10-year-old brain can go, and I couldn't quite picture it. Mm. Like, I had it all sketched out, and then it was this high, and then here's the deep, and here's the parapet, and I couldn't quite figure it out, because when they described the battle, I had to know everything that was happening, you know, like it was the Civil War reenactment, and there's something about that connection between that kind of rational.
That's a really good way to put it, the Civil War reenactment, because I would feel like you hear it, like hear a story of a war, but you want to like get it right in your head. So like there is that thing where you need to almost like take the salt and pepper shakers and like kind of redo it so you can like kind of figure out how it really happened, even though it's a story and it didn't really happen, but you have that like compulsion to make that thing that grabs your imagination so solidly a reality.
Yeah, and it's something I've always been aware of, but I've never really had a good explanation of why. And then I read Michael's book. So with that, Michael, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Well, hey, Eric and Maja, thanks for having me. I share your devotion to these imaginary worlds and to the kind of concrete tangibility that we want to impute to them.
Well, one of the things that I discovered from your book is that sort of before these major figures that you mostly focus on, Sherlock Holmes, whose own relationship to fantasy is very interesting, and we want to talk more about that, and Tolkien and Lovecraft. You describe a kind of moment in the late 19th century when a sort of new genre emerges, the new romance, which, and part of that world was about creating these marvelous artifacts to go along with these literary fictions as a way to kind of bring them alive a little bit more. Can you talk about just about that? I hadn't really heard about that as a sort of genre or a moment in literary history, which I think people even who are into fantasy might not be really quite aware of.
Yeah, right. No. Well, it was this kind of confluence of different books that critics in the 1880s and 1890s in Great Britain, where these books really were published, began to call the New Romance. And it began with Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. And then came H. Rider Haggard's King Solomon's Mines, and then She, and then among the other books that were included were works by Kipling, Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, Dracula by Bram Stoker, etc. And what the critics meant by the New Romance was this form of romance, unlike, say, Gothic fiction, 18th century, sensational novels of the 1860s. This form of romance was really based in empiricism, in science, and one of the ways it was based in this kind of objective language of science was through the use of sort of appurtenances, what some scholars call today paratext, that is, through the use of footnotes, through the use of maps, through the use of indexes, through the use of glossaries, that gave the imaginary worlds that these authors were creating a kind of tangibility, a kind of objectivity, a kind of scientific basis in imaginary reality, if you will. So, of course, Stevenson's Treasure Island kicked it off. It had this marvelous, very accurate map of Treasure Island. And when Rider Haggard saw this map, he was really inspired when he came to write King Solomon's Mines to create his own realistic map of the voyages into the interior of Africa where they discover this wonderful treasure. And so he had a friend, an artist friend, create a very realistic map that one of the characters would have carried about with him. It was so realistic that it even had blood stains on it, kind of fold-out map. And then for his next book, Rider Haggard, he had the same friend create the potsherd that leads the explorers into Africa to discover this undiscovered world where Ayesha, she who must be obeyed, actually lived. And the potsherd, you know, was physical. It was actually created, and then they took photographs of it. And one of the reasons that the New Romance as a genre could do this was because of innovations in publishing technology, that at this point, by the 1880s, you could do half-tone lithography. You could actually present photographs and create these fold-out maps to kind of add this real scientific verisimilitude to the texts. So the New Romance was really different from the earlier genres that preceded it, precisely by being both extravagantly romantic and imaginative and fantastic, and also grounding this fantasy in this tangible reality that the books themselves, really captured. And I argue, at least, that it was this genre, the New Romance, which, you know, it wasn't just science fiction, it wasn't just fantasy, it was also mystery, Sherlock Holmes, that from this genre of the 1880s, you get the marketing genres of science fiction, detective fiction, and even later fantasy fiction of the 20th century, these genres in the 20th century, 21st century, continue to repeat this highly objectified form of fantasy.
Well, one of the things that I love about that, I mean, you know, when you were describing that in the book, you know, I felt that stirring, that same feeling I had when I was a kid, and it's a very palpable excitement that I have around kind of metafictions, but you know, again, I ask you kind of this question, why? And I think like an important, you know, kind of backstory here to your book, and I know some of your earlier work as well, is there's this sort of dominant idea, you know, famously put forward by the sociologist Max Weber that, you know, the modern era is an era of disenchantment. And in a lot of ways, it's obviously true. We don't live in the same kind of magical universe or a good, deeply religious universe of people in the Middle Ages with their, you know, deities and saints and you know, fairies in the woods or whatever. And yet there's this sort of growing recognition that a lot of the phenomena of the, you know, the last 100, 150 years, popular culture, new religious movements, forms of art and art practice were different ways of trying to kind of balance out or respond to this perceived sense of disenchantment. And so what's so wonderful about the way you present it is, you know, usually people say, oh, yeah, okay, so there's a reaction to the new disenchanted world of industry and science and all the magic's being sapped out of the world, and so let's retreat. Let's hide. Let's go back. Let's have a reactionary movement. And certainly there's a lot of things like that. But what you're pointing out is that these fictions, they're have your cake and eat it too things. They satisfy our desire for reason, for tangible objects, for the feel of history. And at the same time, they provide an entree into forms of enchantment that the kind of culture as a whole is sort of losing touch with.
Yeah, exactly. I think, yes. I think it's because of a kind of increased recognition right at the time that Weber was writing that the imagination is a legitimate source for enchantment, and that it's not the opposite of reason, that in fact reason partakes of the imagination partakes of reason, and so we don't need to divide the two. For so long, I mean really since, you know, the ancient Greeks, right through the late 19th century certainly, so many philosophers really believed that reason was the superior faculty, that the imagination was subordinate to it. And of course, from the 18th century through the 19th century, many among the middle classes were quite worried about the imagination too, because it was an incitement to desire. It was seen to be inherently irrational, a little bit dangerous. You know, you want to kind of keep the imagination down through your use of reason. They didn't really ever see the imagination as compatible with reason. But many of the authors that I'm talking about felt that was ridiculous, in fact, that the imagination and reason are perfectly compatible. This is one reason why Sherlock Holmes became such an iconic character, because he was completely rational, but his form of reason relied on the imagination.
Well, you know, let's talk about that a little bit more, because that seems like a real key thing. Because if someone had said, oh, this guy wrote a book about, you know, metafictional worlds and the history of fantasy, I would think, oh, he's writing about Tolkien, he's writing about H.P. Lovecraft. But actually, I wouldn't necessarily have thought of Sherlock Holmes in that kind of way. But I think part of the key is this term you have, animistic reason. Animistic reason is what you describe Holmes as demonstrating in a way that kind of satisfies, again, both our desire and appreciation for imagination and for reason. So what is animistic reason?
Yeah, well, basically, again, intellectuals like the sociologist Max Weber and others, philosophers, many of them, until about, you know, the mid to late 19th century, really cordoned off reason from the imagination, from feelings, from the intuition. But beginning in the mid-19th century, some intellectuals, some philosophers, some sociologists began to recognize that, no, this was false, that you can't really cordon the two off, that they actually interpenetrate. And so you kind of get a new anthropology of human nature where animism, the idea that we can kind of enliven the world through our imagination, is not something that is restricted to so-called inferior peoples, which had been a kind of dominant understanding by intellectuals for a very long time. Again, that the imagination is inferior to reason, and therefore the people who are really kind of caught up in the imagination are inferior peoples. By that, these intellectuals, Western intellectuals, meant non-Western peoples, so-called primitive peoples. They meant women. Women, of course, are not as rational as men. They're too caught up in their feelings, intuition, and the imagination. Children are also, caught up in the imagination. They're not so rational. Well, by the late 19th century, more and more intellectuals began to realize, no, this is not really true. And by the early 20th century, they began to recover this notion of animism, that the imagination can imbue the world with magic and import. They began to recognize that Western rational people do this as well. So I find that Sherlock Holmes was a kind of iconic instance of this. That Sherlock Holmes really spoke to people. He became sort of the first character that people, adults actually pretended was real, and were quite open about this, in part because he expressed this notion that reason and the imagination work together to imbue the world with wonder and with import, that the imagination and reason really can re-enchant our world in important ways. And I think this was an answer to this discourse of disenchantment that basically said, the world has become entirely too rational. We've lost those sort of animistic connections with nature, with one another, with the cosmos that the pre-modern world seemed to be characterized by, but we no longer can do this, nor do we want to do this, in fact. We just have to kind of live up to that. We live in this disenchanted world of rationality. It's an instrumental, it's kind of a narrow form of reason that has nothing to do with the imagination. It's a calculating form of reason, and we just have to live up to this. It has benefits. From it we get science, we get medicine, we get technology, we get a lot of things that help us negotiate the world, but we've had to kind of grow up, and we've had to kind of put aside wonder, fantasy, connections of the sort that the pre-modern world once had. Sherlock Holmes was saying to these people was, no, you don't have to give it up at all. Sherlock Holmes was certainly disenchanted with the modern world. He found it to be entirely too rational in many respects. He found that wonder had disappeared from the world. But when crime comes into his life, when these strange occurrences actually take place, the world becomes wondrous again. And how does he deal with this? He deals with it with his reason. He's able to figure out how things actually happen, but reason doesn't take away the wonder. At the end of every story, sure, things have been solved, but there's always another crime. There's always another question. There's always something else that our imagination and our reason can really dig its teeth into, if you will.
Yeah, as one of the readers, okay, not only do you have the enigma, the creation of enigma, the sense of mystery, but it's that the detective, especially the way Holmes does it, is in general, though, the detective genre, it makes all sorts of details potentially very meaningful. So the world is alive with potential connections and potential meanings. And in a medieval or pre-modern context, that might be a magical experience of the world where, everything is about to speak to you, or there's some hidden sign, or the gods are trying to communicate to you through the patterns of the leaves or the birds flying. But in the modern world, the ultimate account will be one that has to do with causality and history and ordinary objects. But on the way to that, everything is potentially meaningful.
That's right. That's right. The correspondences, the world of correspondences of the medieval and early modern worldview still exists for us, if we have the right attitude. And this, I think, is what's really important about this kind of counter-discourse to disenchantment that the New Romance writers and other thinkers in the late 19th and early 20th century began to come up with, and that is that we really should not look at the world as disenchanted. If we do, we'll see it as disenchanted. In a sense, they say, if we look at the world as full of meaning and import, which, in a sense, our imagination is imbuing the world with, we'll find it that way. So really what is happening in the late 19th and early 20th century, I think, is that Romanticism, this is, you know, the Romantics were always arguing this in the late 18th and early 19th century, but they were a minority. The middle classes were very ambivalent about the Romantics because the Romantics were placing such an emphasis on the imagination, and the imagination seemed very scary to the middle classes. So the minority of the Romantics didn't really see their point of view justified until really the late 19th century, early 20th century, and that's the worldview that we still have today, I think, many of us.
I think that so much of that was, something that was brought up, which is about the fear of what the imagination can bring. And mm-hmm. so I think a lot of it ended up being trying to control imagination in people and make it not okay to have those kind of imagined situations, to, like, you know, slap your hand if you were having an erotic fantasy, make all that taboo, because that led to primitivism, right? Primitivism mm-hmm. was bad. So how do we control people's imagination so that we don't have to worry about criminal behavior? So I think that really goes back to the whole Sherlock Holmes thing, is that the Sherlock Holmes kind of had this thing where he did, like, say, yes, you can have reason and imagination, but also looking at how does that imagination lead to all this kind of criminal activity, and the result of being able to just kind of do whatever you want and let your brain go, that can be this dangerous element. And then Sherlock Holmes was the other side of that, where he could bring his reason into it and kind of, like, overdrive those primitive things that lead to criminal acts.
Right, right. It's the discourse of disenchantment, you're absolutely right, was very much a kind of even a Protestant discourse. It was very worried about desire. It was very worried about fantasy. I think that actually towards the late 19th century, we began to see, or certainly these thinkers began to see, that imagination has not led actually to the kind of sort of explosion of primitive desire that many people had feared.
I don't know. Look at internet porn.
Well, sure, it's there, and we live with it, right? But I don't think we necessarily see a vast increase in crime. I mean, this is going into an area that I'm not so sure about myself. I can't tell you specifically, but I think what I found certainly is that we've been able to live quite reasonably with an explosion of the imagination. And what we need to do is figure out, of course, how to deal with the potential for delusion that the imagination always brings, because the imagination, yes, does speak to desire. We do have wishful thinking, and that can overwhelm us over and over and over again. But I think that what we start to see in these authors who are negotiating the imagination, really taking it on board and working with it, is a way to both entertain the imagination and prevent it from deluding us.
Well, yeah, because I think when you do make it taboo, when you force it underground like they did, that actually results in criminal activity.
Yes, that's
I think
it.
That
that's it.
The whole thing with Sherlock Holmes is that if you do subvert that and not try to include imagination in your reason, then you become a criminal.
That's right. Well, criminality, I mean, a lot of the criminals that Sherlock Holmes deals with, I mean, there's Moriarty. He's wonderfully...
Totally.
Totally. But, you know, Moriarty actually is not so imaginative. That's the interesting thing about Moriarty. And this is an insight that John Lellenberg told me about that I thought was absolutely fascinating. Sherlock Holmes is able to use both reason and the imagination and combine them so that you get the best of both worlds. As Eric said, you know, it seems wrong in some ways. You have your cake and eat it too, but why not? I mean, if it works, why not? All right. Moriarty, on the other hand, think about his name, Moriarty. Death. About death. What is he? He's a mathematician. And also, what does he look like? He's desiccated. He's gray. You know, there's nothing enchanting about Moriarty. Moriarty, is, in a sense, is exactly what Max Weber and other sociologists were worried about. It's the triumph of a strictly instrumental, calculating form of reason that has nothing to do with the imagination.
Right, and that's why, like, in contrast, Holmes is, you know, for all his, intellectual ability to engage the police, you know, with the forces of the police and sort of working in a way to sort of keep society going, he's a bohemian,
yes.
You know?
Yes,
and that bohemian quality is sort of making us, and it's a way of saying that bohemianism and all the things associated with it are underserved by looking at it merely as a kind of romantic reaction. That the bohemian position is also an affirmation of a kind of another kind of reason, a more imaginative and in many ways a more tolerant and engaged and enthusiastic reason than the dominant forms of rationality that we see in institutions and that create that kind of modern pessimism about things.
That's right, an animistic form of reason. That's exactly right. And interestingly enough, in the late 19th century, you really see kind of two poles at either end of the spectrum. On the one hand, you see this kind of desiccated form of instrumental rationality that Weber and others were very worried about, and this is a form of reason that has nothing to do with the imagination. And on the other hand, you get the extreme aesthetes, right? You get, sort of the Baudelairean and Haussmannian kind of aesthetes in some ways that go to the opposite extreme and just live in the imagination, and they also are unnerved by rationality. In fact, they see rationality as precisely the problem. Many of the decadents did, anyway. And they see mass culture as part of the problem, too, and they see technology as part of the problem. So they go to the opposite end. They kind of glorify the irrational and the sensational and feelings, and they're not very comfortable with reason. But what's really funny and kind of wonderful is that the new romance, these you know, kind of what we would call hack writers today, I mean, well, you know, science fiction writers, really. I mean, genre writers, that's what we'd call them today. The people that both the sociologists and the high intellectuals on the one hand and the aesthetes on the other disdained, these guys found a perfect marriage between reason and the imagination that I think is really part of our culture today, that we just kind of enact without even really thinking about it.
I totally agree with that, and part of the reason, and this is a whole other point, and we're going to take a break in just a second, but I'll set it in motion here, is that it's not just about what these authors are doing in their writing, or even the, you know, the forms of publishing or the kind of levels of society they reached, you know, they weren't necessarily being read, at least when people were paying attention, by the intellectuals and the avant-garde aesthetes. But it's also that these fictions created a kind of fandom, a kind of way of loving and engaging with literature and with other fans that helped mobilize precisely this mixture of reason and imagination that we still totally have. Internet culture is completely infused, you know, the sort of animated, self-consciously online kind of culture of gaming, of pop culture references, a sort of exuberant goofiness that's ironic but also sincere in its love, is very much derived from the kind of fandom that has grown up around these people that you talk about.
That's exactly right. Another feature of the late 19th century was a kind of collection of spaces, public spheres of the imagination, in a sense, in which people could kind of congregate to kind of collectively imagine these worlds that they so loved. And as a result of this, actually, you get a kind of synergy of many minds, which causes these worlds to kind of come alive from the page and become, in effect, virtual realities that exist beyond the imagination of any individual reader. They're created by many readers. And so on the one hand, you kind of get a proto-virtual reality. These worlds take on a life of their own. And on the other hand, you get another fascinating, if unforeseen, consequence, and that is, as people talk about these worlds and elaborate them, they also start to segue in their discussions of these worlds, these fantasy worlds, into discussing reality. so that there is a kind of interchange between the fantasy world and the real world, and as a way that people can kind of negotiate and discuss in a safe way, a kind of fun, ludic, you know, playful way, they can discuss really important topics of the real world that, in fact, are often difficult to talk about if you just talked about them without this kind of mediating sphere of fantasy worlds.
These are all great issues. I'm going to dive into them in the second half of the program. We've got to take a break right now. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Dahu and Expanding Mind. We're talking to Michael Saylor, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Progressive Radio Network, your source for news and information.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz. Every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hi, you're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
I'm Dr. Peter Bregan, author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness. Listen to my newly syndicated talk show, the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, and find out why they call me the conscience of psychiatry. Hear my cutting-edge guests expose the dangers of conventional psychiatric diagnosis, drugs, and shock treatment. Learn about better ways, better therapeutic and spiritual approaches to healing ourselves and to making the most of our lives in a responsible, loving, and creative manner. Make your life turn out the way you want. Join me every 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, live or on the archive at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dahu here with Eric Davis. We're speaking with Michael Saylor about modern enchantment and his new book, As If. And before the break, you were mentioning a little bit about kind of that distinction between the story and reality and how they get all messed up. And to me, it's something I spend a lot of time thinking about. And I had read Mircea Eliade did a book called Myth and Reality, kind of looking at what is the connection between the stories. Like, are they based on something? Are they telling a history? Is it real, or is it just something made up? And if it's made up, like, where is it coming from? And I always think, like, I would be reading, you know, the Conan the Barbarian books, and I'd feel like I was there in that time, and that Conan was, like, a real person. And then I think about, like, well, what is the mechanism that's happening there to make a virtual reality? When you're reading a story, like a fantasy novel, what to you, kind of, what is that mechanism that allows it to become real in our minds?
Yeah, a really interesting question. Well, okay, here I kind of want to draw a bit on cognitive psychology, because I think there are some potential answers that cognitive psychologists are posing. Some cognitive psychologists argue that, you know, through evolution, we've evolved to look for essences in the world, mysterious underlying essences and agents, because it's a way to survive. It's a way to kind of, through finding patterns in the world and figuring out who does what, we actually are able to negotiate reality more effectively. So it's kind of natural for us to look for the concrete, the tangible, the pattern, something that is underlying, true, and stable in the world and in our fictions. So if we grant that in a sense we're always searching for this, then I think the fantasy worlds that sort of emerged in the late 19th century give us hints of these essences, of these patterns that draw us in like catnip. It's something that we just can't avoid, and we crave, precisely by giving us these kind of backstories, hints of a wider world. And we don't get the full story. We only get hints and clues to the wider world. In the Sherlock Holmes stories, there's constant references to other cases that Dr. Watson...
That mechanism is because it acts as a tool to access our own subconscious?
I think in some ways, yes. I mean, I think that we may well be hardwired to respond to these sorts of cues and clues. And so when authors give them to us, and when they leave them slightly open, we're drawn in. We want to, in a sense, get closure. We want the essence. We want the foundation. We want to have them resolved. And when they're not resolved for us, we start to resolve them for ourselves. Mm. That's where you get fanfic. That's where you start getting people, or you get the Sherlock Holmes phenomenon, where you get these wonderful, the Baker Street Irregulars and others, who actually try to resolve all of the kind of inconsistencies in the canon, and posit their own ingenious solutions.
Yeah, look at Star Trek conventions, right?
Oh yeah, totally, exactly. So I think the kind of paratextual elements we were discussing earlier, the maps, the glossaries, the languages, the footnotes, the backstories, I think all of that may speak, you know, if I don't want to be reductive, and I don't claim to necessarily fully understand what the cognitive psychologists are saying. I only kind of draw on them in terms of for my own uses. But I do think that when you talk about Conan the Barbarian really speaking to you, and, you know, Howard did this. Howard created a whole, you know, Hyperborean age that he had worked out, and he gives you those sorts of clues, and I think that's true for many of the worlds, and it's why we're drawn to them, of these worlds. And the authors were very aware of this, many of them. I mean, Howard was, H.P. Lovecraft was. They were very self-reflexive about what they were doing. And Eric had referred earlier to kind of metafictions, and, you know, these authors were very metafictional in their conscious use of these tools to draw us in and keep us invested in the world, and not only the tools, but then each other, right? Because that's what we then do, and this leads to these worlds becoming virtual because we want to talk about them, you know.
There's almost two forms of virtuality going on. One is that as the fictions start to refer to each other, as they leave hints and they leave threads dangling, we inevitably begin to sort of put them into a single world. We create a meta map that will allow these different stories to work. So with Lovecraft is a great example. You know, even the concept of the Cthulhu mythos, the idea that there is a mythos, is a construction that comes after Lovecraft's time that's trying to sort of speak to something that he was doing very consciously by,
yes,
you know, inviting friends in and encouraging other people to elaborate and making in-jokes and references to his friends and the names of the books and mixing up real books and fake books. So that's kind of a virtual world because we sense that there is a world behind the fiction. I may read the three volumes of The Lord of the Rings, but I know there's a bigger world that's behind it in some way. So that's one kind of virtual reality. But the other one is just what you're starting to talk about here, and that we talked about a little bit before the break with fans, is that this game, you know, it becomes a kind of game that draws in the reader as well as other creators, as well as other writers. And then as we start to play, we realize we're playing collectively and we're communicating with one another.
Yes.
And that itself becomes its own kind of reality, with Holmes, I guess, being the sort of first great example.
Yes, exactly right. It was the first great example. Lovecraft later called what he and his friends were doing an artificial mythology. So again, we get enchantment in the dual ways that you're suggesting, totally. We get enchantment from these wondrous worlds that we know are fictional, but nevertheless they give us these kind of realistic hooks, these paratexts, these rational ways that we can enjoy the enchantment. That's the first way. And then the second way is that then we talk, we play the game with each other. And that is actually gives us a lot in this modern world that Weber and the other sociologists felt that we had lost. First of all, it gives us meaning. It's provisional meaning. It's not universal meaning. In the sociologists at the time believed somehow they had this very romantic notion of the pre-modern world, that somehow there was a communal meaning that everyone shared. You know, a story had been given to us by religion, and we all shared in it, and we all had our place in the great hierarchy of being, etc. And we've lost that. Now we have nothing but provisional meanings, and therefore we're alienated from the world. Well, that's nonsense, because actually we do very well with provisional and contingent meanings about the world, and we share them with one another, we debate them with one another, and it gives us an orientation. We may dispose of it later for a better orientation, but nevertheless we do have meaning, even if it is provisional.
I mean, I think that's so important, and I think it's kind of funny, because it's like we do make up our world. We make believe all these retarded governments and make these structures that really are kind of like fantasy novels. I mean, making the United States of America is a little bit like J.R.R. Tolkien, like writing Middle Earth, you know.
Well, here's the danger, right. Now, we're talking about the cool stuff here, but there's always the danger of being deluded by these fantasies, too. Enchantment, you know, since the Middle Ages meant two things. Never one thing, it meant two things. It meant both to be delighted in wonders and the possibility of being deluded by them, of being placed under a spell. And the dual sense of enchantment dropped out when the sociologists like Weber got hold of the term. They only saw enchantment as delusion. You know, sometimes it could be useful delusion. I mean, Weber did say, you can have mystical states, you can have religious states, but these are inferior to rationality. You can have artistic states of mind, and these are kind of atavistic, and they're crutches, and it's not really where the modern world is at. But, you know, if you need it, you need it. You're too weak to really buck up. All right. Well, what he didn't see, really, was that there's delight and delusion, and we can have both if we're careful. Now, Maja, when you just said that, United States is an imaginary world like Tolkien's world, yeah, that's a problem, in fact. I mean, think of Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany was an entirely enchanted world, and the Nazis very capably fostered this sense that people were craving meaning in Germany in the interwar period, craving solutions to the problems of the time, and the Nazis gave it to them quite deliberately. They gave them an enchanted world, and we too have had our own enchanted worlds in recent history in the United States, of course, etc. So the key thing is to somehow combine reason and the imagination so that we remain delighted but not deluded.
That's where you talk about irony in that context, and that was one of the other things that your history really illuminated for me. This is if anybody kind of wasn't familiar with science fiction fandom or neo-paganism or comic people or people into anime or whatever, and they kind of dipped into their worlds, let's say online on a bulletin board or something, one of the things that you would notice if you were like an anthropologist, you'd go, well, there's a certain kind of humor. There's a certain kind of playful, sometimes snarky, sometimes sarcastic, sometimes seriously goofy ways of kind of referring to in an ironic way to the culture as a whole. And I know it's just this very pervasive sentiment and style in these worlds, and I think that they derive a lot from one of the solutions, or one of the main solutions to the problem that you pose. How do you constantly modify so that you give yourself the pleasure of the enchantment and you allow yourself to truly love it, and at the same time not to become, I mean, you could, as a shorthand, religious about it.
Right.
And the irony operates as this kind of way of modulating that proximity to something that you could take much more serious.
Much more seriously and too far. That's exactly right. Yeah, the ironic imagination really characterizes these worlds. Irony is seen to be kind of a quintessential part of modernism, but you find it certainly in mass culture of the late 19th century, just as modernism is emerging. And it continues, exactly. That is a kind of prophylactic against taking these worlds too seriously and getting lost. And, you know, though, even the most ironic of people, though, can still be overcome by the desires that these worlds prefer. And we have, you know, I kind of discuss cases of this, you know, Thomas Mann, the great German modernist, but also this wonderful psychiatrist, Robert Lindner, who kind of got sucked into the imaginary world of one of his patients to the point where the patient had to get him out of it. The patient was getting very disturbed that he was more interested in the imaginary world than the patient was. So sometimes irony is not enough. There's still a danger, and that's where I think that these public spheres of the imagination can be useful, provided that they're made up of a lot of people with differing views, not the same point of view, but differing views. Because then, you know, your friends can always say, wait a minute, dude, you're getting into this a little bit too much, or you're not quite seeing things the right way, and let me challenge you. Let me challenge your point of view. So irony is really important, and I think also conversations about these worlds is really important. But there's always, again, with enchantment, this is the thing about enchantment, there's always the potential to be deluded. We have to really work at not being deluded. Irony.
Well, and I think that all kind of ties back to, like, what is the difference between the story and the reality? I mean, that thing about delusion is really integral to our understanding of what is real in the world and what is not. And I think that's like a part of our experience of reality in the world. When you see that your imagination can change and make something happen in the world, it's something in your mind. Like, let's say you're Adolf Hitler, and you have this thing, and you see it happen, then you become, like, you think you're God on the earth, and then that becomes, like, your reality, and you can't see the distinction there. And
Steve
that,
Jobs is a great example. Steve Jobs in his reality distortion field. Exactly.
Totally.
You know, and in some ways, the will to believe, you know, you're absolutely right. If you believe it enough, you can make it happen. And Jobs certainly browbeat his workers and his colleagues, and he made things happen that they never thought could happen. But at the same time, and, you know, it's a, who knows what happened with his cancer, but he actually, you know, believed that he could not use traditional medicine initially. He could use non-traditional forms and seemed to disregard the advice of even holistic medicine friends who were into holistic medicine who were telling him, you know, Steve, with this particular form of cancer, I don't think holistic medicine is the only answer. You need to go both ways. You need to listen to your doctor. And with his reality distortion field, he didn't listen. And, you know, we don't know how that may have affected his outcome or not, but nevertheless, it is a kind of admonitory story. One of the things, though, I think that I found by researching this is that people who immerse themselves in imaginary worlds are quite good at distinguishing reality from fantasy. Of course, there's always an overlap, and there are fuzzy overlaps between the real and the imaginary, you know, between you know, facts and fiction. We know that. Nevertheless, people who invest themselves in The Lord of the Rings or the Cthulhu mythos, they know perfectly well that these are fictions. And in fact, if you immerse yourself in them enough, you start to get sick of them. You start to crave reality. It's too much. It's like immersing yourself in anything. So we find that the fans of the Cthulhu mythos, for example, really, if they can afford it, they make pilgrimages to Providence, Rhode Island to take pictures of all the real houses that Lovecraft based his, you know, the shunned house, his fictions on. Or
it's like when you're so into someone and you have this huge crush on them and all you do is think about them all the time and you make up all these stories and then you actually talk to them and they're kind of boring.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's fantasy. Right.
All this sort of, like, you know, reminds me of that great, the fact that, you know, that great etymology, Maja loves etymologies, that the word fan or fanatic originally has an explicitly religious context with someone who's extremely enthusiastic about their particular deity. And when you talk about this sort of issue of the danger of enchantment and the fact that this is clearly this as-if culture you're talking about is a way for modernity to feed some of what is lost with the loss of a pervasive religious worldview, the sort of issue of religion really comes up for me, and that was the main thing I was sort of thinking about in terms of where to go with some of your ideas. Oh. Is that, you know, if you take both Lovecraft and Tolkien, have small but very significant overlaps with modern paganism. That people who were, you know, that clearly, Tolkien fandom. Some of those people were also interested in neo-paganism and nature religions and reconstructing a sort of more imaginative or enchanted world. Same thing with more dark side occultists who are attracted to Lovecraftian mythos, some of whom tell, you know, origin stories that explain why the mythos is actually kind of real, but most of them are perfectly happy for it to be a fiction that they nonetheless incorporate into their practice. And what that made me think of is that the as-if culture you're talking about with pop culture objects is really wonderful, but I know that for me, for example, that most of the forms of it that you see now that are specifically related to media objects, to TV shows or movies or comic books or novels, they don't do it for me anymore. It's mm-hmm. not enough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so for me, part of my own interest in religion, in occultism, in neo-paganism, in psychedelia, in church architecture, what have you, is that because, in a way, this is what religious worlds are. They are these sort
That's
of
right.
constructs of the collective That's right. imagination.
That's
and
right.
I can actually get some of the pleasure I get, or some of the wonder, the intensity that I would get out of Tolkien or Lovecraft, out of religious systems.
Totally
and,
right. Yeah.
And people within those systems also apply that same ironic imagination.
Yes,
they just do it in a different way.
Well, think of Soren Kierkegaard, right, in Fear and Trembling. I mean, he is really, and he, of course, wrote on irony, and much of his work was deliberately ironic. He was very aware that we have to make a leap of faith very often. We have to renew that leap of faith when it comes to religious belief. Why? Because we're inherent ironists. We never fully believe. We constantly have to reaffirm. But by the same token, our irony allows us to entertain possibilities that aren't ruled out as exclusively fictional. That it's quite possible to be a religious person in terms of the ironic imagination, and to entertain possibilities. They're not ruled out at all. And, you know, Tolkien is himself a very good example of this. Tolkien was a devout Roman Catholic, but he even wrote to his son and said, you know, I have to constantly reaffirm my belief all the time. It's why I go to Mass, because I'm a doubter as well. And I think that's the nature of being human in some ways, that we do doubt, that we do have, it's another word, a term I use in the book, we do have a kind of double-minded consciousness. And that I think, again, in the late 19th century, there was more of a recognition that it was okay to have a double consciousness, to both believe and disbelieve at the same time. But this double consciousness doesn't just work for fantasy fiction. It works for, I think, everything.
Well, and that's what keeps us from delusion, right? When we have the double consciousness, we become Sherlock Holmes, where we can see it imaginally, but then we can also, like, keep it in check so we don't become Adolf Hitler.
That's right. That's right. It's exactly right. But it's when, in a sense, we're challenged, when we're anxious, when we're fearful, then I don't think we really have the room to have a double consciousness often.
We
have to believe, because that's the only solution at that time. And so, in a sense, that's when double consciousness may shut down temporarily or for long term, perhaps. But I think, by and large, it's a skill that we practice, and that very often we don't even practice. We just kind of enact quite unconsciously. That, you know, the kind of either-or sense that we have to be one thing or the other thing is not true to how we actually cognitively operate. That it's often both and we just have to live with these contradictions. And
I think another really good example of that is relationships. You know, that if you lose the wonder, if you lose the ability to, and when you're with someone for a long time, you're married for a long time, it's an active, constructive process to create the opportunity for enchantment to occur. But if you're only going for enchantment, if you only believe in the God of the love, you're going to hit the ground really with a lot of pain. You have to be able to apply reason and detachment and conversation and negotiation. And if you don't have those two poles, it's going to be a rough ride.
That's totally right. That's totally right. In a sense, we've been enchanted by that false notion of what love really is, although more and more, of course, people are always saying, no, there's this whole other side, and you have to just get real. Exactly. And we even have rituals to kind of recreate enchantment for romantic relationships, just like what we had 2 days ago, although it's not a really good ritual. I don't think it really necessarily is.
It's funny because the actual real ritual of that, the pagan holiday Valentine's Day was based on, is Lupercalia, which is the day of the she-wolf that raised Romulus and Remus. And it was a fertility ritual where everyone would get naked and they'd slap each other on the belly to, like, get pregnant. So, I mean, ritually, to give people, like, hearts on Valentine's Day, everyone should be running around naked and slapping each other on the belly.
No, I think maybe they do that after dinner.
And a final note, we only have a couple minutes left here, but I just wanted to emphasize one thing we haven't talked about too much, is how much there is a real political dimension to what you're talking about, in the sense that you're affirming that there's a certain aspect of fan culture, a certain aspect of the culture that we see widespread online, a lot in popular culture, that's actually significant in the way in which it negotiates reason, wonderment, and the necessary kind of dialogue between different perspectives that allow those worlds to exist, and that it's not just, oh, look at the cool, wacky pop culture people who are interested in, you know, anime toys or whatever.
Right.
But there's something more here that's more fundamental, more central to our experience as modern people.
Yes, it is. What these worlds do is they kind of train us to think in terms of the fictions of our everyday life. They train us to be self-reflexive, I think, to see stories and the stories of our own life, in fact, and the political world, et cetera. All of these are provisional and contingent. They are meant to be negotiated through conversation, where we need to keep our minds open to alternative stories or alternative narratives that might be better fits. And I think, you know, that's a kind of liberal ideal anyway, but we see an alternate in our political culture always of essentialist stories that, of course, appeal to our desires that don't provide much room for this. So I think that the value of certainly fantasy fiction is that it's a constant ongoing training in being open to alternative narratives, including those of our own life. And hopefully then we can have a kind of more progressive conversation with one another of all stripes. People of all political persuasions can do this, of course.
Wonderful. We're going to have to stop there. Michael, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thanks.
All right, Michael's book, As If, Modern Enchantment and the Literary Prehistory of Virtual Reality. So from Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.